Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
What's good, internet? It is Monday, September 10th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 185. I am your host, Austin Walker, and joining me today, an illustrious crew. It's Waypoint Radio's people. It's us. It is Danielle Riendo.
Hello.
Hi. Patrick Klepek.
I can't feel anything anymore.
Rob Zachney.
He's numb.
I don't know what Patrick's on about. I played Spider-Man last night.
Wait, did you do that after the game?
Right.
What game?
Yep.
That's, Shout outs to the people of Chicago for kicking things off right.
Oh, that's what it is. Okay.
It wouldn't be real if your hearts weren't broken. You know that.
Okay. I can't do it.
You almost called me Boston. That's how distraught you are.
I can't. I don't even want to go there.
He came back. Aaron Rodgers came back out and brought it back for him.
He didn't have a leg.
It was like, okay, so there was this game, a very important game, an NFC conference game, where Jay Cutler hurt his knee.
He did.
And played a particularly Cutler-esque game, played shitty, left the game.
They got better.
And he got dragged to hell and back and 2 degrees reputation, never fully bounced back.
Yeah, that was it.
This was like the nightmarish reverse of that coin, where it was like, and first, it was actually a huge relief to see Aaron Rodgers come back out, because when he got carted off, like, it was scary. Like, Aaron Rodgers is a great player. You really don't.
Injuries are bad.
Yes.
And
they
like,
sure are.
He is a treat to watch. Like, it is, like, amazing. Even as he was, like, deconstructing the Bears' defense, it was still awesome. Nevertheless, he comes back, and you're like, oh, how good can he be? He looked like, basically, like, his career might be ending at the halftime. And then he came out, and he just ruined everything. He, and like, he just ripped my soul from my body.
It was a good moment, because Rob's, somebody other, had gone to bed. Mine had also gone to bed. My wife went to bed. She's like, it's 20-0. I'm tired. My ass is going to bed. Bears pulled it off. And then, like, Rob and I slowly had to watch this unravel. We became each other's significant others last night.
You're allowed to be that. You know, I think that's fair.
We knew. We were like Patrick said, like, even during halftime, he was like, I still feel like something's going to go wrong.
We're
still
up 20 points, and I feel no confidence whatsoever. This is just what life has trained me for, the brutal realities of being a Bears fan, and that's what
it
is.
I'm glad you had each other in this moment of darkness.
Thank you.
I'm glad, Rob, that you had Spider-Man to go to as soon as the horror was over. How's that treating you?
It's treating me pretty well. I think, like, a thing that has definitely caught me off guard is that there's a lot to combat in that game. Like, there's a lot of stuff Spider-Man can do, and it's tricky because, like, a lot of games with a kind of simplified combat system, it's very easy to sort of muddle your way through just by mashing buttons really fast, and like, stuff happens and you win. But that almost makes it harder to learn, because there are enough, like, difficult encounters that you actually do want to get good at being, like, Spider-Man in combat. And so if you start, like, leaning on that, just, like, mashing all the buttons and watching crazy Spidey shit happen, you're actually going to have a lot of trouble in this game, because then you're not going to have the control over the engagement you need to have to really excel once you've got, like, a heavy, one of the sort of bull rusher characters, and, like, two guys with guns and a bunch of brawlers. That things get pretty hairy, and you need to actually have some finesse.
It's a game whose combat floor is surprisingly high, but its ceiling is also surprisingly low. So, like, the arc you'll end up going through is that once you wrap your head around those basics of, like, dealing with X, Y, and Z, it's, like, very thrilling for a little while and then becomes, like, frustratingly rote because the game stops throwing additional tricks at you. It's just sort of like, oh, you figured that all that stuff out? Cool. Like, you're good.
Well, there's just a ton of combat. Like, it does not stop. You're just constantly stopping crimes, and the majority of the like main story missions end up devolving into a big you know bash at the end, and so you end up finding that same loop that works for you, that same set of combos, and it's like, yeah, okay. It's one of the reasons why I do my best to play that game in stealth whenever I can, because I actually think the stealth felt a lot better, especially once you start getting some more of the stealthy abilities.
Where I got to last night was a sequence at a gallery where you play as MJ, actually.
Yeah, that sequence and, that sequence rough, I say.
Well, but I ended up like I liked it a lot in the sense that like playing as MJ and like just doing a bunch of investigation shit was cool. And like this is the thing that's missing from a lot like a lot of great comic books have multiple point of view characters.
Yes, 100%.
Games trap you in one. And it was so cool having this beat where it's set up where, like, oh, here's MJ doing investigation stuff that sets up the broader context of the story that Spider-Man is going to be operating in. But then also you go from that into, like, them starting out some relationship stuff, too, that, like, creates – it's such a cool little touch. Like, if nothing else from this game gets stolen, like, relentlessly – I want that to be stolen. Like
more
point
switches.
Of view characters.
Yeah, totally. Well, and I'm happy that she is a perspective character who you play as. Miles is also a character in that game. Miles Morales, who you play as.
So and he's separate from Spider-Man.
Yeah. Yes.
You're like Peter Parker.
Brief sequences. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to be clear. You're not like playing as Miles. Like I haven't finished this game yet. I don't.
You play as Miles.
No, I'm saying I have not played as Miles Morales, Ultimate Spider-Man. You know what I mean? I have not done that.
That's
at the point in the game that I'm at. I'm playing Miles Morales, young kid from New York.
I see. Okay, so
whose story intersects with Spider-Man's?
I'm confused again.
I was of the impression that Miles Morales is one of the Spider's Man.
Yeah, well, but that has to happen.
In the comics, but you may be confusing
it's
with
the
movie.
It's in the future?
The movie that's coming out in December, he is the star, but not in this video game.
Okay.
Right. In this game, he is Miles Morales, the son of Jefferson Davis, a cop.
A cop.
Sorry, what?
Right. Okay.
Yeah, you'll see. Which means his so if he had taken his father's last name, he'd be Miles Davis. Get it? Shout outs to Brian Michael Bendis
Miles
for the
Prower,
worst.
Miles Prower, right?
That's him.
That's his name?
Yep, okay. Tails. Tails, man. Yeah, Miles is there as a kid, right? Like as a teenager. And his story intersects with Spider-Man's. There's a playable segment that I've played. I don't know if there's more than that. I suspect there's another playable segment or two. Yeah, that's my guess. And I have no idea where it goes. But, like, I love switching to those perspectives. That stuff worked for me pretty much all the way through. Or all the way through as far as I am at this point. But I do think that, like, the stealth mechanics in the sections I've played that are from other perspective characters have not been super fun. Because you go from having all of this expressivity as Spider-Man to being characters who basically have like one axis of things to do, and it's that axis is don't get seen or like take a picture. And I like taking pictures. I loved actually the first half of that MJ bit where you're just like taking pictures of all the gallery space.
Mm-hmm.
Like I just wanted to do that on my own without having the objective to do it. That part was really dope. And I want to I'm with you. More of that in games in general, please.
They also do a really – I don't want to spoil how it plays out, but they do some smart overlaps between characters and the perspective shifting. Like,
ooh, awesome.
People know what I mean when you encounter this sequence, and it's the kind of thing that, oh boy, I wish the game had done this like five more times. And maybe part of the reason it works is because they only do it once. But it shows the potential for if – you know, this game is an inevitable sequel or other games and superhero games in general, like the ways they can have those perspectives interact and do mechanically clever things. Cool. I wish the game did more of that, but there's a specific sequence that is a ton of fun because of the way they kind of like flip the script on you.
Cool.
So a question I had, did you find this vision of New York in its cleanliness and brightness almost sinister?
I mean, what cleanliness and brightness? There's a gunfight on every corner.
Yeah, but like...
I have like literally the opposite impression of it as someone who lives in New York, which is like, it is the most cynical version of New York I've ever fucking seen. I've like, it is a vision of New York that does not ever explain why a person would live in New York outside of like Peter Parker is a nice guy. Like there is literally a robbery happening constantly in that game. There are drug dealers that Peter Parker has to bust, and let me tell you, he's so happy to bust drug deals. He's never been happier. He loves sending drug dealers to jail. That is his number one favorite thing to do.
And getting those surveillance towers working again.
Yeah, can I ask about this? As somebody who doesn't even necessarily like Spider-Man that much, I don't hate him, he's just never been my guy. It seems like this is like Spider-Man the cop, the game. That's what I'm seeing.
He has
an alter
ego in the game that he talks about and brags about called Spider-Cop. So,
God.
There is a through line in this game. This is something I'm going to write about later this week about sort of like... Like the game takes like a very pro surveillance stance, but not necessarily arguing for surveillance. Like there are undercurrents to like, for example, Peter Parker, like by unlocking these towers, participating in like a surveillance state. Then the Alex Jones character of J. Jonah Jameson is the one who's pushing back, saying like, "I said we shouldn't do this shit. This is a bad idea to let Oscorp like tap into the police and let you know." So they're like these weird political undercurrents.
Right, but the other stuff that he says is that Spider-Man is going to eat your babies.
Right, exactly.
And so the mixing of those two things ends up being really tough, right?
Yeah.
In general, it does feel like, you know, this is a game where there's a lot of dramatic irony, where immediately you, the player, know what the fuck is up with Doc Ock. You know what's going on with, like,
who?
Some
other... Who? What's that character?
Dr. Otto Octavius. I've never heard him called anything else.
Yes.
Sony certainly didn't send us an email being upset with us for using the word octopus in our paragraph about how good the handling of Dr. Otto Octavius is.
Wow.
That definitely did not occur.
But that email is under embargo.
It might be. I don't know.
2099, you can open that email.
God damn it.
Sony's official stance basically is like Spider-Man 2 totally sucked. No reason anyone should have seen it.
Well, like, and I get it to some degree. I do think that it's fair to be like, hey, you know, a lot of people haven't. Homecoming is the first thing they've seen from Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. I get that. I get it a little bit. But his name is Dr. Otto Octavius, and the game, the first frame with him in it is him with like four giant octopus arms attached to him
while things are going wrong.
Right, like they're gonna make that character happen, and then they pull back, and instead they develop him in a really cool way, like Patrick described in the review. I'm not gonna hammer on this. I think that game is solid. I think that like I need to finish it because the thing that I'm trying to work through is how much the game knows that Peter Parker is kind of a simp, kind of just like a naive white dude who trusts in the institutions. I know, Patrick, you wrote about his belief that people could change for the better and how that kind of bites him in the ass at some places. But I think there is a world in which I like a story of Peter Parker learning that the reason he has to be Spider-Man is because actually they're the systems of justice and the systems of the city that he loves are not actually helping everybody.
I don't know how much the game is aware of that side of it, but it sets up a lot of interesting threads that hopefully if they choose to pick up on those threads in like the most of what the game plays with is like his bias towards like forgiveness and like empathy and people eventually doing or potentially doing the right thing. But it does set up like threads like the surveillance stuff, like, you know, deference to like Oscorp and other institutions that if there would be a very interesting sequel that like, okay, like the naiveness of Peter Parker and like Spider-Man like ends up like really fucking him in ways that he finally is forced to like recognize like the wrongness or at least why there should be a healthy distrust of the institutions, even if you end up participating in them because in his mind, the ends justify the means. But in this version of Peter Parker and Spider-Man, there is no questioning of the why. It's just, of course.
Right. Speaking of things where I feel like the main character's perspective is a little bit called into question, the question of whether or not a game would be better off with other perspective characters, certainly. The game that just – the review embargo just came up today for Shadow of the Tomb Raider. And I believe that all of you have put some time into it. We have a review up on the site by Dia Lucina, who did an incredible job. Just recorded a podcast article read that should be in the feed by the time you hear this. It is in the feed now, right? And a conversation with Rob Zachney. So I know, Rob, you've been talked out about Tomb Raider, but I want to know from y'all three. You know, I edited Dia's review, so I know what her perspective is on it. But how do you feel about the game so far, given how much time you've put into it?
So who's played the most? We should probably figure that part out first, right?
I've made it to the hub area, which is about 4 or 5 hours into the game, I think.
That's a little more than me.
I only got to the plane crash.
All right, so early game feelings then, presumably.
Yeah, Danielle, go ahead.
Yeah.
All right, I mean, I'm even less than that. I'm only a couple hours in. But yeah, I'm having some tension with this game because I loved the second one. I didn't actually play the first one, but the second one, Rise of the Tomb Raider, I thought was one of the most fun sort of video game-ass video games I've played in a long time. It was one of the only, like, AAA games I beat that year, like in 2016, I think, like New Year's Day 2016 or something.
Right.
just a really, really fun mix of mostly the sort of challenge tombs that are just puzzles, you know, sort of like action-adventure puzzles, 3D puzzling, and then, of course, the sort of fun traversal stuff. I love climbing, I love jumping, I love swimming, I love doing all that stuff. And the combat has always been fine. You know, nothing necessarily amazing, but there's a lot of sort of crafting to support it. There's some stealth. So I've always just enjoyed the pace of those games. It's been really, really fun. So I'm playing this and I'm enjoying it, and also definitely seeing everything that Dia, pointed out in her review, which is a pretty muddled take on Lara Croft. I should also say, like, super, super briefly, I had a friend who worked on the game, so full disclosure, I don't think she's even in the credits. She worked on it for a time. But it seems like this game wants to kind of have its cake and eat it too regarding, you know what? It's actually pretty fucked up to be both a white savior and also a white person, a very, very privileged, rich white person who goes around to other cultures and steals their artifacts. That's pretty fucked up. But also, isn't it really fun to do that? It seems to already be kind of doing that. And much more so, it's much more pointed in this game than the last one. The story in the last game was utterly incomprehensible.
The larger conspiracy plot of this arc has been just complete nonsense in a way that is not I love me some fucking nonsense. Like, I watch horror movies, like, you know, most days of the week. So I have a high tolerance for nonsense, but these are just so muddled in a way that it's not even like fun, goofy national treasure. It's just like, really, like, this is, yeah. So, but you know, I think the characterization of Laura has been interesting, or at least like curious to watch how they've handled that. And I'm with you, Danielle. Like, the explorer, I love exploring big spaces. I think like it is rooted probably in our shared appreciation for platformers. Like, there is that stuff there, even though these games aren't platformers. It's a game that like rewards exploring spaces and attention to detail. Like, that's a part they got, I think, like, really finely tuned in the second one. Like, that was I did, like, 98% of the game. Like, I found most of the shit in that game because it was just deeply satisfying to do it. I could feel parts of those itches being scratched in the third one. You know, like, these things, they specifically have these things called challenge tombs that are, like, puzzles and platforming things that it's, like, you have to, you know, try and conveniently, like, look away from, you know, like, the problematic way it's, like, implemented and contextualized in the game. But, like, it runs up against, like, yeah, but, like, I really love doing these fucking puzzles. This part of it is, like, designed really well, and I think parts of that are carried through into the third one. But then, like, there's a really weird inconsistencies in Dia touched this in her review, where it's like, you know, it's like putting like a meaningful like steps forward for like acknowledgement and like trying to be more sort of like culturally aware. And there's this one thing the game doesn't surface, but I dug into the menus because I was messing with some of the sound settings, and there's one called it's in like the VO settings. It's like immersive dialogue.
Immersive dialogue, is that what it is? Yeah, Natalie is in the room and is nodding. Yeah.
So I flipped it on because I was like, oh, like, I love playing games in, like, the native language. Like, I think hey, when Metro Exodus comes out, like, yo, like, you should play that with, like, you know, the Russian turned on. Like, it is so much more an enjoyable game to be in that atmosphere. I think it really enhances the experience. And so I was like, oh, one, it's kind of weird that given all the other things that have been forward-facing, saying we're taking this stuff really seriously, that seems like that should have been an option up front. Like, hey, like, want to turn on, like, the native dialect of, like, the people you're going to encounter? I was like, cool. So I put that on by accident because I stumbled into it. But then this... Like, Laura doesn't speak. She only speaks English. Like, she doesn't flip over to, like, speaking in the tongues of the people around her. Which, and so she's having conversations with people who, like, it's, I mean, it's,
you the know, fiction again. Of this world is, I just want to make, I haven't played this game. Uh-huh. I've read the, she's super I've read the Diaz review. Huh?
She's super smart. Like, this is like right. She's super a smart.
She knows these well, languages. Right. Like, that's we know in that the she fiction knows, of the world.
Because yeah. Some of the languages are just, like, Spanish. They're right. Like, she could have learned in
this isn't
in
like
her
some
life.
Ancient, like, you know, abandoned right. language. There'd be no way for her to know. Even though in this series, like, it is set up to, like, yeah, but she'd fucking know that one anyway.
Right. But
yeah.
Here's the part that I don't understand is she goes to this city called PyTT. That's, like, the hub for this game. It is a city that has not been touched by the West, right? Or until maybe recent.
Recently, like an oil company came or something like
that. Something like that,
the
right?
The West has touched this place. It is not completely untouched by
okay.
The outside world.
But everybody there knows English super well enough to talk to Laura?
Enough that, like, the back and forth, like, there's not even some sort of, like, if at least the game did some sort of acknowledgement that, like...
Not that I want a lot of, like, brown people NPCs being like, I don't understand what she's saying. But also, I do kind of want a bunch of NPCs be like, I don't know what this white woman is even fucking talking about right now. That would actually be dope.
Yeah.
It's not immersive. I'm actually going to flip it off because it actually is completely weird, bizarre,
it
off-putting
like it
to watch
calls
her.
Attention.
Yes,
because
it's not natural at fucking all. Like, on one hand, I'm getting, like, this, like, you know, I can't judge the VO. I don't know if it's any good, but it sounds... like, interesting and more naturalistic to me, and in a sense where, like, you had, you know, Laura, even if it was, like, stumbling through, like, making some fucking attempt to, like, speak, like, even if, like, she was doing, like, the white person thing of, like, I can only fit in some phrasing, like, if there was a, like, hey, immersive means, like, she's going to, it's driving me up a wall, where I've had it on for 45 minutes, I'm gonna go back and turn it off, because it's not enhancing my experience of the game. I'd rather actually just listen to these people speak in English, because... that's just, you know, that's just easier to... I'm not going to be frustrated every 30 seconds when I hear this person sounding, right. You know, completely naturalistic Spanish and then just, like, Laura stumbling through her... It's just, it's fucking weird and fits the... It is, to a T, fits the sort of, like, you know, tried to take a step forward but was unwilling to do the full
right.
commitment, which is basically, you know, Diaz's argument in review, and my guess is, based on what I've seen so far, I'd probably largely end up agreeing with, is, okay, if you're going to do this, okay, so when we saw that, when we did our E3 uh-huh. conversation about this, Austin, where we thought, man, this could be interesting, where the side character, whose name I'm blanking on, but
Jacob?
Who has been with, you
Jonah.
Know, been in this...
Hi,
the,
Jonah.
Jonah.
Hi, Natalie.
Jonah Jacob.
Jacob is a character.
Jonah Jacobson.
Jacob...
Jacob's a character from the second game who has some wild-ass powers.
Who is... Yeah, maybe not spoilers.
Oh, I remember Jacob.
He's
okay.
A werewolf. Right, right, Rob. Yep. Exactly. Also, hi, Natalie.
Hi,
Natalie was
so... I've been listening into this.
Just like, quivering.
So drift compatible with Patrick right now, so synced up with the frustration that she is like, you gotta turn on my microphone, I gotta jump in.
So, when we had our E3 conversation, one of the things that we thought maybe gave some credence to, like, oh, they're going to, like, take this seriously in some mention was that,
yeah.
Is that sequence where Laura gets yelled at? Like, she's been told, like, you are not the star of this, like, maybe this fucking, you know, tsunami just happened, and it's not
right,
because you picked up a goddamn dagger. And then
imagine if someone in your life was like, this hurricane happened because of me. Like, motherfucker, it is not all about you.
Yeah.
Chill.
Right, right. And so, and the thing that he says is that what we're going to do is not, you know, go off on a plane and go on to the next tomb that you're going to go check out. We're actually going to stay here. We're going to help these people, and we're going to, like, help clean up this mess. And I thought, oh, when this demo cut to black, like, what's going to happen in the game is, like, I'm going to spend, like, an hour here with these people. Like, I'm going to, like, participate in the cleaning up of that mess. Like, this game is going to show, and normally these adventures where you trigger something cataclysmic, like, it just cuts to the next scene, but you don't see the devastation. This game is going to answer that. It's like, oh, yes, like, something awful happened. And you're not just going to hear about staying, like, you're going to stay here and, like, meet these people for, like, before you go off. And maybe it's still a deus ex machina that, like, gets you to go off to the next thing, but you're going to revel in this consequence for a little while. And instead it's just cut to black, boom, we're on a plane. And, like, all, like, I'm just like, it was so frustrating because it's not even the game wants to eat its cake and eat its too. It wants to get credit for raising a question that it doesn't seem interested in even answering.
Right.
And that is that's more frustrating than just had they said, fuck it, we're just making a swashbuckling, like, Indiana Jones style thing again, and we're just going to ignore the problematic elements and just lean into what we've done before. It's more frustrating. You're like, hey, we're going to try, but not
actually.
But not really, but clap for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, when just speaking to the immersion thing, like, that was definitely something that had me turn off the game very quickly after starting. Because that was the first, I mean, the first thing I do whenever I start up a game is go through accessibility settings, go through voice settings, as I always like to put subtitles on because I miss a lot of dialogue.
Yeah.
So I turned on the immersion thing and hearing Lara, you know, speak, because she's understanding them.
Right.
Because they're there's entire conversations happening between Lara and, like, a Spanish speaker.
And no pause. Not like, she's thinking about what they said. It's just like, boom, boom,
no,
boom,
no,
boom,
she,
boom,
she,
boom.
She fully understands what they're saying. And I know Lara took fucking Spanish 101. Like, I know she knows this stuff. But for me, it wouldn't be something, I mean, I intend to keep playing the game, but for me, it's more important to have the voices of those Spanish speakers in the game rather than, like, my own disruption of the immersion, because having just the fact that I can hear Spanish being spoken in a game is so significant. And at least I can, like, ignore Lara for a second and just imagine that they're speaking to me.
Yes.
And that's meaningful to me. So for me, I wouldn't jump to turning it off, because I think that that entire thing is very meaningful and significant that it's even happening. Even though Lara's responding in English, that is just, I mean, it's just so silly when you see her, like, walking through crowds and she's like, excuse me, like, you can't say, like, con permiso, you can't just, like, walk through and say anything, like, I don't know.
If anything, it just ends up underscoring, like, this, like, larger criticism of, like, this shitty white girl, like,
but
just, like, going.
It emphasizes that this is Lara's world. Is really what it is. It emphasizes that this is Lara's world.
Right, right, right.
That, like, everything, it's like Lara centrism. I don't know. Like,
right.
Lara,
everything Lara.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, it revolves,
like, the sun,
around. Exactly.
Lara,
she
is the sun.
Of Tomb Raider's, she is
world.
The sun. Exactly. Because everyone can also understand her.
Right.
Which is, like, what you were talking about earlier, Austin, is, like, why, you know.
I want to be clear. I'm not saying that.
Like,
that
why would these
people
understand English? Right.
Right. I'm not saying there, like, aren't people in Mexico who understand English. Of course, there are lots of people all around the world who understand English.
Exactly.
But
I've been made that.
But the reason they understand English is because, like, America and the West made you understand English if you want to operate in the fucking world.
Exactly.
And
thanks,
it's
globalization.
Not your, right. And it's not your native tongue.
Exactly.
And, like, it would be dope to actually have some of it be like, because there is stuff with language in this game.
Yeah.
Right?
Like,
there
put
are,
a, put a trans, like, I don't know. What,
yeah.
She has so many, from what I understand, is that she gains, you know, a lot of companions that are some of these Spanish speakers from these communities. Use them as a translator, even if just,
yeah, if she had someone walk around with her, that would have been something.
Yeah, like, if you're going to stick to the point that Lara, you know, isn't going to speak Spanish, then use a translator. What would you do if you were in this place and you didn't speak
Spanish? And also, let her speak Spanish. Like,
just
record some of those lines in Spanish.
Have her speak Spanish, some English, you know, accented Spanish. I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
That's fine.
That, well, because they seem to do so, like, one of the things that Dia, you know, liked about the game was a lot of the commitment to, like, showing, like, lots of these native people and, like, in many ways being respectful of their culture and, like, certain parts of it, right? Like, she has large critique, but, like, so it's that way.
There's
of,
definitely,
like,
an attention to detail,
yes,
in terms of portraying the visuals, like, the visual spaces of where these people live and,
right,
and what these people actually look like. I mean, they look, you know, it's not just, it is very, like, a Mayan indigenous. I'm half Guatemalan and have family members who are of indigenous descent. I don't claim any indigeneity, but there is like a certain like physical characteristic that is very characteristically Mayan, and seeing that is like amazing. Like, I love to see that. And seeing, you know, the depictions of you know, the Dia de los Muertos in the first town that you land in, and, you know, seeing the ofrendas and all the things like that. Like, that is really, really cool.
That's not nothing.
That's not nothing.
Right. Well, like, it feels like this whole game is such a tension between the gameplay design, which wants to be a straightforward AAA, like, stealth action game.
Yeah.
Where you're getting collectibles and you're going through a progression tree and you are, you're going into places and coming out with new things, right? That is such a trope of what this type of game is, mm-hmm. across the Uncharted games, across like the Assassin's Creed games, across mm-hmm. it's a genre thing of like, I'm going to get better at this game mm-hmm. as I continue through the game. Like mm-hmm. that is part of what the progression arc looks like. And I'm not saying that progression arc is intrinsically – actually, a long time ago, another game critic, Stephen Byrne, wrote this criticism about – the leveling up system, how leveling up systems are intrinsically caught up in a sort of capitalistic understanding of mm-hmm. progression, which I don't think it holds exactly, because I can conceive of, because communism and socialism are anti-capitalist and are fundamentally about making a world in which you can improve yourself more mm-hmm. easily, in which mm-hmm. you can actually pursue your dreams and
skill is not necessarily 100% money. Yeah.
Exactly, 100%.
Skill acquisition is an inherent sort of human
totally
trait, but that is not necessarily yeah. Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah, 100%. But in a game like this, what ends up happening is that you end up seeing that the confines of the design end up coming into direct conflict with or kind of trapping the story that wants to be in this other shape, right? Like, it's stories aren't water. You can't just pour them into whatever vessel you want and expect them to maintain their form.
Especially if you're you are physically acting out that story. Like, you have to be the water.
Right. Right.
So you can't – I mean, you can't just move – I don't know. You can't just move wherever you want. Totally. Like, there is a design to it.
And my suspicion is that the writing team on this game and the art team in this game and the design team on this game all had slightly different objectives, and that, like – If any other person was in charge inside of that team, I bet we would see a slightly different game, or if their goals were different. Like, there's definitely a story to be told as to how the game came out like this, in this kind of way
I'm
that
really
feels like
that.
A compromise, you know, across a bunch of different lines.
It's a third one, right? Like,
yes,
this would be,
and it's
this
not
would,
the
if this was them
team.
Starting another series. You know, I mean, it's just like you can see how things get muddled pretty quickly on something like this.
If you want more conversation about Rise of the Tomb Raider, Shadow of the Tomb Raider.
Shout out.
Rob, you had a great conversation with Dia. Do you want to really quickly just like give some other big time conversation points that you had in that conversation for people to go listen to?
Well, I mean, one important beat, like to what Natalie was talking about, is even that form of representation, like seeing the Dia de los Muertos, like celebration in that town. Even that, like, Dia had a very good insight, which is that compared to, like, an Assassin's Creed game or, you know, a game like The Witcher, where, like, there's this idea of people going about the routine, and there's a sense of, like, life and community that is independent of the player.
Right.
Dia was like, actually, the way this stuff is represented and portrayed, it's still very consumptive in its relationship to you, the player. Like, it's a diorama is what you're going through in that town, Dia de los Muertos. Like,
totally.
Nobody moves from their station. They all hold – they sit there in front of the ofrendas and they don't move. You are there to look at them and move on. And you can't interact with them. And they have no like hint of inner life or other routines they follow. That's right. Just what they're there to do. Because in this game's telling, it's sort of as Dia put it, sort of the National Geographic lens, but in game form. In this game's telling – oh, this is what Mexican people do. And so even that form of representation, like it struck me and I had a warmer reaction to it, but talking to Dia about it, like sort of changed my perspective on it. For me, the big question, and like this is why Dia and I ended up talking for like an hour, is that I could never work out whether the game knows how off Lara is. Like, from the first, her inability to relate or empathize to any of the people around her is like striking. Like the beat you guys talked about where where Jonah's like, not everything's about you, Lara. We're going to sit here and we're going to help these people. The next shot is of them flying off to the next tomb they're right. going to raid. And it's from Lara's point of view. Jonah's not talking to her. And she's trying to, like, he's still pissed at her and, like, distressed by what they've just gone through and what he's just seen. And the whole tension of that scene isn't, like, Lara coming to terms with her responsibility. The tension is Lara just wanting this guy to talk to her again. Like, so things can right. go back to normal.
But we didn't see the fight, right? We didn't see whatever happened to make her convince him to get on the plane. Yeah. I think there's a version of this game that's more honest, maybe, that yeah. is like, he says, it's not all about you. We're going to stay here and clean this up.
And Lara's like, no, we got
to
go.
We actually have to go. You're wrong about this.
Yeah.
But, like, if you're not going to show her be that person and all you're going to get is her swooping in to save the day, like, in the new place, then yeah. you're retreating from actually confronting some of the topics that Jonah is trying to set up with that dialogue, right?
She doesn't listen. It's striking. She does not listen to people. Jonah's like, we need to help people here. We, like, there's people here we can help. And her response is to just keep repeating, this is my fault, but not really. We have to go stop Dominguez and his crew. I can fix this. That is her entire chain of thought. This, like, show of responsibility, and then, like, but we need to do what I say, and these other people are the bad ones.
I just want to believe in my heart of hearts that there's a meta reading here where a writer is, like, basically in the perspective of Jonah, and, like, a game director or an exec or somebody in a suit who makes the big business decisions is the Lara who's like, you got a point, but I don't care. We're doing this instead.
Jump on this plane. Yep. 100%. 100%. God. Yeah, I sometimes I've said this before, but, like, being in the margins means kind of finding it where you can get it in terms of representation, yeah. in terms of people making art that does conceive of your perspective to begin with. And I would just wish we saw a little bit more of it. Someone on Twitter asked me, I don't want to be clear, like, they were being very polite in this. They were like, well, what are games that don't put the player at the center, which I think is a very understandable gut reaction to the sort of criticism that's levied at Shadow of the Tomb Raider. You go, well, but wait, don't all games put the player at the center? And I think that that is partially comes from an ongoing conversation we all had about the move towards or the long history of focus on power fantasy. But it's such an all-encompassing criticism to be like, well, games always put the player at the center, that it elides a lot of nuance that is important and distinct. So, like, even inside of action games, there is a range of you know, we tried out the Far Cry 2 versus Far Cry 5 example all day and say that Far Cry 2 is much less concerned with making the player feel good than Far Cry 5 is. But even in a broad – once you take games much more broadly than that, you start looking at things like the Abe's Odyssey games in which the Mudokons, who are like the alien or like the character that Abe is in those games, their physical attributes are specifically made to be oppressed. And so, like, moving through the spaces where, like, the big, strong, tough dudes with guns are supposed to be moved through is a fucking hassle. And yes, you are given the abilities to work through that, but there's something being said about the fact that to succeed in that world means to take control of the bodies of the people who's built the world in their image. Or looking at something else, like, you look at something like Crusader Kings 2, in which the player is just one of 10,000 actors in a system that are all acting in accordance to the rules of the system. That game has – it's player-centric in that there's an interface for you to interact with, but it isn't player-centric in that same way. And so it's one of the ways that I hope – and also, they're not all power fantasies are the same. Cameron Kunzelman wrote that great piece for us during our Gun Week earlier this year about needing more types of power fantasy. You know, he really wants there to be, what is the Black Panther of video games, right? Mm-hmm. That examines, you know, very literally, Black Panther is not a movie with a lot of guns in the hands of heroes. And so they have to find other solutions. And sometimes it just means punching, right? I'm not, like, no doubt. But there is something different happening there than just pointing a gun and pulling a trigger and having the world change to be more like what you want it to be. And so I think it's important in a situation like this when we start with the game is so focused on Lara Croft that it can't actually give you the representation of the world that even the people on the writing team seem to want to deliver, that the next step shouldn't just be, and that's just because it's a video game. It should be, how can we imagine a better world? How can we imagine a game that actually does this differently? We already have this potential solutions. We talked 10 minutes ago, 15 minutes ago, about how great it was to have perspective characters in Spider-Man. Like, imagine a version of Shadow of the Tomb Raider that occasionally puts you in Jonah's position, yeah, or puts you in the – maybe not even occasionally.
What if she left – And then
you stay as Jonah?
And he says, fuck it, I'm staying here. And then it's like contrasting between, like, you going off on these, like, it'd be an interesting way that the game could even allow you to still have, like, the weirdly problematic elements, like the challenge tombs, because, like, you're doing this, and then it's cutting to Jonah doing, like, mundane, like, moving stones, getting food for people. there are ways that, yes, they could have taken things like the Spider-Man does and done some really fascinating contrast that in some ways maybe like would make you feel guilty about some of like the mechanically like and design stuff that you're enjoying from this game.
And I don't think that is a hand washing thing.
Yeah,
but
I don't think it's that. I think for me it's put Jonah in a decision making position. Mm. Like when you do that perspective shift, give a significant meaningful decision for him to make that will impact the story. Like let him make a decision.
Right.
For everyone, that's not just, you know, oh, we're going to go see what it's, you know, like to be Jonah and what it's like to play, you know, the big bulky, you know, whatever that thing is. Like, if it's, you know, whatever
it's so
trope
easy to
that fulfills.
It bad, right?
Yeah,
it's so
the bad version of that is you play, like, you know, strong man who, like, gets to...
He moves crates.
He moves crates and things like that.
Right.
No, give puzzles.
You know, yeah, give decisions about how to interact with this community and rebuild or whatever. Give decisions for the actual mission that he's, like, embarking on with Lara. I think that just transporting into their perspective is so transient, and there's not a lot of... I mean, although it is a step towards, like, a more meaningful thing, I think... It gets lost in the main storyline.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, like, could we get to a place where there's a point at which even that feels like having its cake and eating it too, probably. But I still think that there is a way in which we should.
But that you can disrupt Lara.
Right.
That's what I'm looking
for. That's the real
thing.
That would be actually really fast.
Yeah, if you could, if that decision, I'm not saying make a decision, do we go here or here? I'm saying, I'm saying, where are we dropping?
That's it. Where are we dropping, Lara? Everybody get out. We're going to talk about Battle Royale, and just after the break, we'll be right back with that. Listen. But for now, we're just talking about Tomb Raider.
Okay. Sorry, I got excited.
But I guess it doesn't seem like they would ever have the courage, or who knows? Maybe I don't know.
They might have the courage, but I don't know if the shareholders do.
Well,
I mean?
I guess what I'm saying, like,
Lara in the suit said no.
Like we have a game that, like, you know, has a reading in which it's like in some way saying like she's shitty, but it's not. That's a reading. It shouldn't be a reading. That should just be explicit.
The text.
That shouldn't be like, oh, you could look at this and be like, wow, you look at this and you could just take away. They're like, she's a bad person. When it should be that the game is overtly showing you that she's a bad. It is saying she is a bad person as opposed to like having to read a critical analysis that would explain to you why she's a bad person. And,
yeah, but
that's a much more difficult proposition to pull off, especially in a third one. And yes, as Austin mentioned, I don't know if they would let them commercially even do a game like that.
But we play shitty people in games all the time. Like, that's nothing.
Playing shitty and then saying, like, the person you're playing is a bad person, those are different things, I think.
Like, the GTA characters are mass murderers and are...
But they're glorified.
But, like, yeah, they're not an attack on the institution and ideology of...
Yeah.
I mean, I think the characters in GTA often are an attack on American ideology, but not one that actually has any weight because the degree
of...
Or nuance, or like any lasting power. I don't think anyone leaves GTA 5 and goes like, "Man, we should really change the way America works."
Yeah, like sex workers need more protection. Like, well, no one's
certainly not that in GTA 5 or any GTA game,
or even like that torture scene from GTA 5.
Fuck, that scene's so fucking ridiculous. Yep. Rob,
I was just thinking like, I think the problem, one of the problems this game has is like, this isn't even necessarily like woke Lara. It is not all white people Lara.
Right.
And like, I think that is the perspective it's coming from. Like, it wants to indict certain structures and systems and legacies, but it doesn't want to indict anyone now for that status quo. You know what I mean? Like, Lara, like, it wants like, Lara's hands to remain clean, like relatively clean, in terms of the situation she finds. but like anything she's done, it's because she just didn't know. And like now that she's been made aware of an issue, of course she will engage constructively with it and help.
Right.
And help in this case also means take charge and then dictate how this situation is going to be resolved to everyone's satisfaction.
Convince those who are rightly in charge that they should listen to you, actually, the outsider who knows about Trinity and knows about the situation. I've dealt with them before. You know.
Yeah.
I have the expertise.
And so I think that's kind of the real – like – it is always eye-opening to see when the conversation shifts to, man, we need to destroy systems of colonial oppression and white supremacy. The sheer number of people who you would not expect to immediately feel indicted by statements like that that are pretty milquetoast,
yeah,
who suddenly are like, well, wait, what do you mean?
We should reform them, Rob. We can fix them from the inside. We don't have to destroy anything. If you destroy something, you have to start building from scratch again, and that just takes way longer. We should all just reform the world slowly and calmly. It'll be fine. Which I mean, I guess is the meta question about Tomb Raider, right? And this is the question that Dia asks at the end of the piece is like, you know, and I think it's back to the conversation we're having now around Tomb Raider is like, why, if your goal is to write a game, if your goal is to make, if you say the way I want to make Tomb Raider is to make an indictment of raiding tombs and to make it so that we get, when we leave this game, that raiding tombs is shitty actually, why are you making Tomb Raider? I mean, the answer is because you're employed and you have health coverage and you have a family and like I get all, and someone from above said, oh yeah, we got the next Tomb Raider game, you know, Crystal Dynamics is off making something else. We're going to make the new one. And I get that, like, it is because of the state of precarity that we all live in 2018, it is hard to be like, oh, I'm actually going to quit my job, lose my benefits, and go find something else. I 100% understand that. But at the same time, there is something disingenuous about going into that project being like, okay, and actually we're going to make the game about how Lara is wrong. And I think that disconnect of like, how are you going to commit 3 years of your life developing this game about how this game is bad? Mm-hmm. There's going to be issues there. They're going to be – those pressures are going to like peak. They're going to hit each other and peak as mountains. And you're going to – all of the inconsistencies around the immersive dialogue stuff, around the way that Lara's worst actions aren't being shown on screen. Like that stuff ends up being – the result of an incongruity between the goals of wanting to critique the thing and the desire to make one of these that is fun.
Yeah, and I mean,
you probably can't even do that in a Tomb Raider game, right? That has to be like come from the outside.
Probably, I don't know.
I don't know. I think there is room to. I don't know.
Because at what point is this? We go back to the episode y'all did that was really great on
rehabilitation
redemption and
abuse. Right? I've been thinking about that a lot throughout this conversation, but I think that it's Lara's never the one being punished for her actions. There's nothing, you are never like at a set, you never have like a, you never taken a step back and you're like, okay, you know, now I have this obstacle. Like it's never really that tangible because it's always, it is Lara's playground. It is Lara's world. She's always going to be able, it is her fantasy at that. So she's always going to, there's always going to be a happy ending. There's always going to be a way for her to navigate to the finish line,
right,
whatever that finish line is. And although I mean, I haven't finished the game. I'm interested to see what that ending sequence looks like. And I don't know what it is yet. My guess is it's not, you know, Lara, you are being stripped of, you know, your Tomb Raider status or whatever. It's
the Tomb Raider Council.
Yeah.
That's exactly Tomb Raider right. House.
Tomb Raider her House mansion. Tomb Raider.
Right. Her mansion becomes away. A school to teach programming. That's what it is.
Oh, boy. Rob, I understand that your conversation with Dia does get into some spoiler territory. So if people do want to hear some of that stuff, they can go listen to that.
Dia went full spoiler right from the start. I was like, we need to hold these for the back. Okay, and we hit the first point of discussion. I was like, let's talk about Dominguez. And she pauses for a second and she's like, okay, so basically right at the end. And I was like, you know what? We're just going to roll with this. Okay. Let's just...
So go check that out. We're going to take a quick break. And we will be right back to talk about some other stuff, some Valkyria Chronicles and some blackout mode, some Call of Duty blackout.
Some Call of Duty.
Which is the new Battle Royale mode. We'll take a quick break.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
How do y'all feel about anime?
I like anime.
Oh, hold on. So, last night,
It's a good start to any story.
If you hit me up on my IG, and I also was on Twitter.
Catch Patrick on the gram, you know.
Catch me on the gram.
It's the best place, honestly. The best place.
I was not home this weekend, but the rest of my family, my wonderful wife and daughter were. And I wanted to leave a protector for them behind. And so, thankfully, the weekend before, when I was also gone, I was given a protector for my family, my sweet farm boy, Donald from Fire Emblem, in a pillow-like form was given to me. And when I was packing to leave, I was like, I'm going to put this on the bed. It's a spread. It's not in its pillow form, but it can kind of lie along the pillows and the blanket. And it's here, you know, where I would normally be sleeping. And now it's here.
On your side of the bed?
Yep. On my side of the bed. It replaced me. And I was okay with that. I was fine with it.
2018.
And I forgot that I did. Like, I did the tweet. Did the IG and I forgot about it, thinking at some point like I'm going to get some sort of angry screed from my wife, like what the fuck did you leave on this bed? Because I never showed her I got this, so she had no idea that I got this gift. It was just going to be something that she found. And then like randomly right before she went to bed last night, as she was feeling good about the bears, she turns to me and she goes, "I forgot to tell you about that fucking thing that you left on the bed." Your daughter went in there and was rolling around with it and thought it was hilarious. I walked in and just saw what appeared to be a cartoon stranger on my bed.
Oh,
she's like, you're lucky I didn't burn that thing. And I was like, honey, that actually would have been hilarious if your response to it was to publicly burn it and then send me photos of it. But she didn't. Aww. And instead she folded it up very nicely and then put it underneath my bedstand. So
that's where Donald he is now. Shout outs to Waypoint fan Caitlin for sending that in to Patrick. She sent it here, and because it's the easiest way to get stuff to Patrick, it was right before PAX, and so I packed it into my stuff. I brought it out to Seattle, and I'd forgotten about it for a whole day, and I was like going through my luggage, and I found it there. And I want to be clear, I had no idea what it was. I could kind of tell it was a body pillow case based on like the texture and like the color.
You could?
All right.
You just feel that it was a body pillow case?
Listen, catch me at Otakon 2005.
I think I know what this is.
I grew up in anime. I'm from anime.
Okay, you're from anime.
He slept with anime.
Anime only adopted you. Like, I was like, I'm pretty sure this is a body pillow, but I could not tell of what because it was all folded. So I delivered it to Patrick, and we discovered it in joy together. If I could just live in the 1 second between me recognizing what it was and Patrick recognizing what it was forever, I would do that. Just looping. And that's what heaven is like to me.
That sounds like a beautiful moment.
It was a beautiful moment. The recognition. Perfect. So good. I'm talking about a different type of anime tactics, though, still.
Anime tactics?
Anime tactics. Not Fire Emblem this time, but Valkyria Chronicles 4, comes out in a couple of weeks, but the review embargo was today. We don't have a review up because I am 28 hours into that game and only in chapter 11 of 18. So it's sizable.
It's Japanese.
It's a Japanese tactical RPG. But if you've played these games, if you played the first game, which is the one that came out here on a major console.
It's then, coming out on Switch in October.
No. The first game is coming out on Switch in October. Yeah. Okay. The Valkyria Chronicles 4 is hitting Switch in 2 weeks, on like the 24th, I want to say.
Wow.
It's hitting Switch. It's hitting PS4. It's hitting Xbox One and I think PC. It's everywhere. It is a sequel to that first game. So the first game, like this one, both of them are tactical RPGs in which instead of just moving people around on tiles, it kind of puts you in a third-person action-style mode with them where you're running them around and they kind of have a bar of stamina that depletes as you move them around. And so you kind of like run them up to some sandbags and kneel and like take aim. Because it's in this kind of fictionalized anime version of World War II, instead of taking place in Europe, it takes place in Europa. You know, instead of New York. Yeah, it's basically that. It's basically New York, but Europe.
Good.
In both of these games, in both 1 and in 4, you actually play people who join into the conflict. They are originally in kind of a neutral territory. This place is called Gallia, which is like their stand-in for Holland. Holland, right?
It's weird. In their version, okay. Like Holland turns into like a serious military power.
It's so weird.
It's like it's very hilarious. Like Germany, Russia invades. And like
right. It's one. Also, they combine Germany and Russia into one.
And the Dutch are basically like, well, this is not going to happen. We're not letting this go down on our watch. We've got a tank.
You got to draw a line somewhere. You know, that's what Picard taught me. You have a tank, and it's a game. It's a World War II style anime military tactics game in which you have a group of different characters. There's like, you know, you have a ton of characters who all have these traits. So they all have classes. So maybe you have like a shock trooper who has like a machine gun or like a submachine gun who can do lots of damage up close. And you have scouts who can see really far and who can shoot really far, but they don't shoot a lot of bullets. You have snipers. You have like heavy lancers who are like they use bazookas, but their bazookas just look like European medieval lances, which is
incredible.
And now there's grenadiers who have mortars who let you do indirect fire, and they're incredible. And on top of that, each character, it's not like XCOM where it's randomly rolled characters, and it's not like Fire Emblem where I guess it's more like Fire Emblem. But in Fire Emblem, most of the traits tend to just be about, like, what your stat line is. Mm-hmm. In what makes Valkyria Chronicles so special is that characters end up having these kind of four potentials that are about who they are as a person. And then they can gain more depending on how the story – depending on some story events and depending on how you upgrade the class. So for instance, maybe you have a character who loves nature. They have the nature lover trait. And so if you're fighting in the wilderness, like and they're running through a field of flowers, that you get like the anime cut in, their face comes across the screen. It says, you know, nature lover, and they get an accuracy up or a damage up or something, right?
That's extremely good.
This actually does get cool to the point of like, because you'll have different – it's not just different biomes. You'll have like city slicker and like, oh, there's a paved sidewalk going through this forest. If you end your turn on that paved sidewalk, your like bog standard soldier turns into the fucking Terminator.
Yeah, it's super rad. It's like, okay, I'm going to have to find this stuff. It's goofy. It's super goofy. And the opposite thing can happen too, where it's like this person hates the dust of cities. And so like, well, I deployed this fucking scout who's like this country bumpkin in the middle of this raid in the Imperial capital. And now he's just fucked because he's just miserable because he's around dust and smoke all day. It's very good. All that stuff is still there. So like, Rob, you played that first game. It's that again.
Did they keep the school anime aspect of
it? No. Valkyria, okay. It's such a weird arc. Valkyria Chronicles 1 is like a bunch of young people from anime Holland who go off to war because their hometown is attacked. Valkyria Chronicles 2 is literally – it's on the PSP only, and that was literally a high school anime where like you're in military school and also training to go to war, and then you go to war, but you're all just literally high school students.
Is there romance?
Maybe I would like that.
I think you would like that a lot. You can still play it on Vita if you have a Vita. Three is just straight up, and three never was localized, and it breaks my fucking heart because it's just the Dirty Dozen. It's a group of criminals who are put in an elite covert ops unit that needs to sneak behind enemy lines and is like disavowed, but like you have to fight for your freedom. And this one is. In some ways, the most interesting because it's the most straightforward. You are again from Anime Holland, and you join the Allies, and your hometown was attacked to the degree that you've named your tank after it. The name of your hometown is Hoffen, and the name of your tank is Hoffen. At the beginning of the game, the setup is just you're part of the big push. You're part of the big operation. You're kind of part of like the market garden of this war, where the goal is to do this huge push quickly into the empire, into the heart of it, and cut it off. And like the motto of this operation is like home before winter or peace before winter. Right?
Always a good sign.
Always a good sign to go east into the Russian territory and believe that you're going to win before winter hits. You know, they don't win before winter hits. The first, like, seven missions are just being part of the Alliance military operation. And it actually does something that past games haven't done super well, which is it makes you – in Valkyria Chronicles 1, you never really feel like you're part of a larger war effort. You're always part of these little skirmishes, and they're important. You take over a bridge so that supplies can get passed or whatever. Maybe you deal damage to a mining operation and you free a bunch of slaves. This game has lots of weirdness. This is absolutely a Japanese game that has a very specific way of handling the actual dark events of World War II. So, for instance, there is still an ethnic minority in this game, and they're called the Darksin, and they have like kind of like blue-black hair and are, you know, considered by a lot of people in Europa to be like – to have been historically their oppressors, and they blame them for all of the downfall of Europe over the years. And it's very much a Jewish analog. And in the first game, you absolutely rolled into like a labor camp and had to free a bunch of Darksin. And it's like, okay, like they're trying to tackle this stuff, but it often will swing between like, we freed a bunch of slaves to time for the anime beach episode. Wow. And it goes like back and forth but like that in this really rapid fire way that can be hard to deal with, because when it goes dark, it feels dark. And in this game, the bulk of that darkness so far has been about the general cost of war. It's the first time that I felt like in one of these games, in the Valkyria games, that my unit is part of a big push. There's like a really great three mission run in the kind of end of the first act where you're going to like make the big push and break through the big defensive line. And there's a mission there that's like one of my all time favorite tactics missions now. Is the sense of the scale of combat was just really fantastic. And then you, of course, the snow falls and you get cut off. And then the bulk of the game is kind of being behind enemy lines, trying to figure out how you can get resupplied, your morale falling apart, figuring out that there are some secret operations going on, betrayal, love, you know, anime shit, all the anime shit. It's the game that I think people who have been wanting a Valkyria Chronicles follow-up for decades – or for like 10 years now, 11 years, 12 years are finally getting. And that is exciting. There is some stuff that I think is – they don't deal with exactly super well. I think in general there are lots of like rad women characters in this game, but it's lots of women who are defined by their relationships with dudes. Mm. Not everyone. I want to be clear. I think there's a lot who are not. But like if there is an anime trope with women that you are like, ugh, about, it's probably in this game somewhere. There are like 50 recruitable characters, which means there's a lot of room for them to check boxes, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I do think there are some incredible standout characters, and I'm pretty happy with Rosetta, who was a character who I mentioned a few episodes ago. There is a character who is in this game, again, every character has traits, but they also have like a bio that gets filled out as you play with them. And Rosetta is her bio is like uses another name, says like, oh, this character was born with another name and presents as feminine. And it's like, okay, is this like a trans character? They never use those words. Mm-hmm. They never say this character is trans, but it's very clear in the playing that this is supposed to be a trans woman. And not only that, like her arc is dope. Her like actual backstory is basically she was a nun She was a trans nun whose partner, also I don't know what religion is like in this world, but I guess she had a partner, whose partner was a Darkson rights activist who gets killed off screen. This isn't like a thing that we see. And after that, she learns that like, oh, you can't beat fascists by talking. And so she becomes like – go ahead.
I was just – is that like – are those flashbacks or are those just written bio that like, you get to read?
It's a written bio you get to read, but it also comes up in dialogue. Like Fire Emblem, characters can bond.
Yeah.
But it's just preset groupings of characters. So it's like she is set to bond with this Darkson dude who is like a grave robber and a loner, and this war orphan who is like – all sunshine and happiness. And so once you use them in some combination enough, you unlock a side story with them about, you know, the world is terrible. How do we move forward in it? And I think it's a little saccharine. I don't actually love their particular side story that much, but she is fucking dope, like character of the year. They don't stick the landing 100%, but the fact that I can say I'm playing this game in which this ex-nun, you know, trans scout is like all about – like literally the thing she says in combat is like you can't change the world with ideas alone. Like cocks her fucking gun. Let's kill some fascists. She doesn't say let's kill some fascists, but she basically does. So I'm super here for that.
But she actually does kill the fascists.
She absolutely
does. She doesn't
even have to say it. Yes, yeah. Totally. If you liked the first Valkyria game, I think this is going to be one that continues to scratch that itch. There's a bunch of other new stuff that I'll write about when I get around to writing the review after I dump probably another 20 hours into this thing. We'll see. Rob, I'm curious what your take will be on it, because I know you were someone who enjoyed that first game, even though it's not a perfect game by any means.
No, but I mean, the art style went such a long way with that game. Like, such a gorgeous and charming game. Actually, the big stumbling point for me was legitimately I could not stand the way Alicia was characterized as, like, literally, like, the sun rose and set with Welkin for her in that game.
Yes, 100%.
And no matter how serious it was, things got, the Japanese voice direction at least, which was generally better across the board in that game, but her character was always really chirpy, particularly toward him. And so, like, again, bad shit could have just happened. And she's like, Welkin. She used to be a baker. So she's like, baguette? And it's like...
So, like, I'm going to spoil one early game mission here, which is, again, that speaks, I think, to the fucking... The tonal thing here of like you need to know what this is before you go into it. Otherwise, you'll be infuriated. There is a moment where you have occupied an enemy city, and your crew, which includes this dude Raz, who is like a womanizer who absolutely is seen slapping an ass early on in the game. Like, again, I'm not apologizing for Raz. He is like, yeah, man, I can't wait to get into town. They're going to have the three things you need: booze, babes, and bacon. And it's like, all right, what the fuck are you talking about? And then there's another character named Kai, who is like your team sniper, and she is like, you know, cool and collected, but still has a heart of gold. Like, they're obviously going to pair up, I'm guessing. She's like, what about bread? Bread's more important than all of those. And you go into town to buy bread, bacon, booze, and presumably meet some babes. But it turns out, someone's already bought all the bacon and all the booze and all the bread. And it turns out it's a rival squad. It's another one of the squads.
Made of babes?
Led by two babes. Absolutely by a babe named Minerva and her second-in-command, Crystal, who is absolutely in love with her. Like, in the notes is like – it's they're going down again, a kind of problematic trope of like the obsessed – like unrequited lesbian love.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's all the way unrequited. I ship them 100%. And Minerva's fucking incredible. She's a super high collar. Anyway, she rolled in and bought all the bacon and booze and bread. And so in the occupied town, you have a mock battle over who gets to keep the bacon and the booze and the bread. And I feel like that's not a thing you should do in a town you're occupying. I think that's what gets you fucking... got. Like, that's what makes you lose the support of the locals, in my opinion. And, you know, a mission later, it's like, I can't believe we're starving to death on the front lines.
Oh,
like, yeah, motherfucker, save the bread. Like, you need that to eat. I like it a lot. It is my problematic fave. It is a fun thing to play a tactics game that is vague in a way that's different than XCOM. We play a lot of XCOM, and so it's like, a 95% hit chance. It could be a 0% hit chance.
Yeah.
Here, there's no percentages. It's not like, you have a 90% chance to hit. You have like an aiming reticle, and it's bigger than just your center point, and so shots can go anywhere inside of that reticle. So it's like kind of a soft there's like an ambiguity. It's not board game like in any way. It's not trying to be that in any way. You know, you don't have particular, there's no tiles of movement, and all of that kind of softness around it makes it feel like a different type of tactics game, and I like that quite a bit. Anyway, that is my thoughts right now on Valkyria. Who knows, in a week I could come back and be like, there is something really bad at the very end of that game, I cannot recommend it anymore. Or I could say, hey, they really stuck the landing.
Anime can go anywhere.
You know what? That's what I always say. Anime, it can go anywhere. speaking of things that can go anywhere and ways that you can go anywhere, Call of Duty Blackout changes Call of Duty in some big, weird ways.
Extremely big and
you
weird.
You can go anywhere, which is the opposite of what I think of as a Call of Duty multiplayer mode.
You can really go any. You can go up and anywhere.
You wow. actually can. There's helicopters. So, Call of Duty Black Ops 4.
Bloppy is 4.
Bloppy's 4. Thank you. Thank you for the technical term. Yep. Is coming out next month. Does anybody know off the top of their head when that release is? I should.
Can check.
Patrick just shrugged in the best possible way. I believe it's next month. And it doesn't have some things, like a story mode. But it is going to have a Battle Royale mode.
October 12th.
October 12th. Wow. Like a month and a day. Is that your birthday?
It's my brother's birthday.
Okay. Shout outs to Natalie's brother. Happy birthday.
And my grandma's.
Wow.
Same day.
Wow.
It's beautiful.
Is your grandmother going to play some Black Ops to celebrate?
Absolutely fucking not. No.
Disagree. Well, maybe when she hears about the new Blackout mode.
Yeah, let me tell Grandma Marie, let me tell you about this new Blackout mode.
Grandma Marie, do you want wall running? No!
Grandma Marie is a purist when it comes to Call of Duty.
Yeah, she liked it the way it used to be. The good old days.
Good old days. Good old gamer.
So they announced at the Call of Duty like experience Black Ops event, whatever the announcement for Black Ops 4, that there would be a Battle Royale mode called Blackout. It's the Call of Duty version of the Battle Royale, the take on Battle Royale. And it is in open beta today for people who pre-order. And I want to say maybe for people who have PS Plus or something.
I think PS Plus is maybe tomorrow. Or maybe that's today, and then tomorrow's open beta on PC.
Sure.
Something like that.
We spent the morning watching some other people playing it and dipping in a little bit with it also.
Yes, Austin played.
I played a little bit. We watched some people
not
at
bad.
IGN.
Not
I did
bad.
All right. I got top 10. I got like
top,
number 8.
Top 8. You yeah, got top 8. Number 7, I think you were.
Kato, Natalie, you watched a bunch of that with me. You saw me playing it a little bit.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah. It's the... Okay, so...
Also, hi, Kato is here also.
Hi, Kato.
I'm here now. The engagement range feels wrong for the space is what I got from most of it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, unless you're in a map, right? And so, like, for the people who don't know, the way this map is, it's, like, old Call of Duty maps.
Yeah,
that
it's like Nuketown.
Like,
it's the estates.
They
or
just dropped them all and, like, connected them with, you know, forest
terrain. Yeah.
Hilly land.
Yeah.
And, like... If you're having an engagement within one of those spots, it feels right because that's how that was designed for those guns and everything.
It's fast in those spots. There's like a train yard where you can get into some like wild Call of Duty style, quick turning around, getting lost in the level architecture, sneaking around on people's stuff.
Sliding.
Lots of sliding. No wall running. Yes, sliding.
But then if you have an engagement in these in-between spaces, it feels off, especially if you've played PUBG before. Like, you had like some sort of automatic rifle, and you were taking shots at a guy, and like in PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, you would have had that person.
Oh, I hit him a bunch.
You hit, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Like, it felt like that distance was just wrong for the gun in this game, but like they don't have. There's like no in between there,
right?
Right. Like there was no.
I got like
gun,
a pretty far
there's no
off...
gun type that you had that would have been. Good for
You only get two guns. It's the other thing.
Yeah.
There's
and
no sidearm.
Usually, I mean, PUBG, you get three, right?
Yeah, you have a pistol and then two real, like, weapons.
Yeah.
So, like, and at least in Fortnite, you can...
You carry, like, whatever you want.
A gajillion guns.
Yeah.
But you always have, you know, your close range, your mid range, your far range.
Yeah.
Like you, how, whatever type of player you are, that's pretty typical across the board. And the fact that you only have two guns, and I felt like, we don't know what these guns are yet.
Yeah, I've not played the Black Ops games in a fucking forever time. And so it's like, oh, a G77 showed up. Like, I don't know what that is. I haven't been up on this stuff at all. It's something you'll learn with time, obviously.
Right.
And those weapons all see, there's like some cool stuff in there. I think that's one of the strangest things with watching people play this and with playing it myself is just like, oh, right, this is a AAA game. So right. One, it looks pretty good. It runs really well. We were playing on a PS4 Pro. Two, it is filled with stuff. Like AAA has a commitment to excess that something like Battle the PlayerUnknown's team does not. And so you end up with a situation where it's like we found like there's perks in this game.
Yeah.
And
the perks are cool.
Are things like let you take less damage from the wall if you're outside of the wall or
an audio cue when someone has their sight on you.
Right, exactly.
Which is, all those things are really
are interesting and they're consumable. Or like it has like it's a little bit more like Fortnite in that it's willing to get a little goofier. Mm-hmm. So like there's a grappling hook pickup you can get. There are cluster bombs. There's a system that like counters nearby explosives.
Yeah.
There are helicopters in this game.
That you can drive.
That you can fly around, which seems so counterintuitive to the battle royale genre. But it's really cool because it ends up just feeling like there's lots of toys to play with.
Yeah, totally.
And that is sometimes what I want in a multiplayer, especially in a multiplayer game.
Yeah.
It makes me super curious to see what the Battlefield version of the Battle Royale is, too, because that's a series that I more closely associate with that feeling of being in a toy box, in a sandbox.
Totally.
But I really enjoyed it so far.
Yeah. It was just so, you said this before, but it was just so fast. I don't think I could, your heels and your...
can you heal at the same time?
It's wild. You can move and heal at the same time.
Whoa.
You can move and revive at the same time.
And it heals
There's
fast.
There's a perk that allows you to... One of the perks allows you to move that you picked up today to move and...
Reload.
Shoot.
Yeah, you'd sprint.
While sprinting.
Not just run, but sprint.
Sprint and
shoot. Or heal at the same time. It's such a fast thing. And it's a reminder for me of just like how fertile the battle royale genre is for people to keep iterating. I think in my mind, it had felt like PUBG did pretty well, and then Fortnite figured it out, and, like, good luck moving in on Fortnite.
Right.
I still kind of feel like good luck. No one's going to do Fortnite numbers. I don't think this game is going to do Fortnite numbers. I don't think Battlefield's is. You know, maybe 4 years from now we see something that pivots in some new way or, there's a new evolution. Excuse me. There's a new evolution. But I think I underestimated how interested I would be in just other versions of this basic game mode.
Right.
Because it's cool to figure out what the new sets of stuff, the new sets of gear and interactive stuff
is. It's new challenge modifiers for it's like almost as if you were doing it yourself. Like, okay, I'm going to only allow myself to do this and this. It's like adding mods to the original game that just keeps it more interesting and more innovative and a fresh feel.
Yeah, or like even just the speedy action feels so distinct from what I'm used to in PUBG and Fortnite. Even Fortnite, which I think is a fast game compared to PUBG, does not have that same Call of Duty. Like when you're up close with someone in Call of Duty and you're turning corners and sneaking up on them or they're behind you, you're like, oh, it's done. And so up close, there's a speed and it's very scary still.
Yeah.
The thing that's new is, as Kato, you mentioned, the long range fights feel so off right now.
Yeah, at least coming from PUBG, it felt like there wasn't this medium range is medium range for a COD game, but with the spaces in between these maps, that's longer than what that range is. Right.
I never felt.
So you're talking about sniping or
in PUBG you have short, medium, and long, and it feels like at any range you have options for that. And this, just from the amounts that we've been watching, it felt like there was short and medium, but the medium didn't fill the space from medium to long.
I see.
Like that in between space, there's a gap where things are too long for the medium range guns, and you can probably snipe at that range, but it's gonna be harder because you're zooming in, right? It feels like there's a little bit there where because Call of Duty is normally such a close quarters game, it feels wrong now just because I'm coming from the experience where you have that entire range filled in.
Yep.
I wonder if the arenas are designed in such a way to mitigate that, or is that still seem like such a problem?
Right. Well, it's because
like the arenas are like the individual kind of cities, but then in between is where if you get into engagements in between, it feels wrong, like not quite there, or like just I'm not used to that yet, so it feels strange, right?
Like, even coming from PUBG to Fortnite, it felt like those middle areas still felt fairly comparable.
Right.
Yeah. But I will say that there are a lot of vehicles in this game, so I feel like not a lot of the combat is actually supposed to take place in these middle areas.
Right.
I think you're supposed to be on the move to other arena sort of spaces rather than, you know, sticking to the sort of outskirts of those places.
I badly want to play with a group of people because I feel like squads will make it feel much different.
And I really want to use the Jack in the Box and see what happens because I have so many questions about what happens. Because in the trailer, there's a zombie.
There is.
In the trailer.
Right.
And there's Jack in the Boxes in the game, which is a grenade, basically, that you throw in zombie mode that will attract zombies and they'll conglomerate around the grenade and then they blow up. And it's very fun and satisfying. It's my favorite part about zombies. And there's Jack in the Box in the game. And at first I was like, oh, maybe it's like it attracts players. I don't know.
Sure.
But I think that what it does
is like a fake. What if it was like a fake crate? That would be dope. If it put the blue,
that would be
really good.
And then blows up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be good. But I think what it does is it brings out zombies.
We'll see. I would love
that. My guess.
That would be damn.
I'm curious if it's that. It could also be a
certain
dedicated
map.
Yeah, zombies.
Yeah, certain
mode.
Arenas have like zombie enemies.
We'll see. But it's definitely the first thing that I've been like, oh wow, I kind of want to buy this game now so I can actually check out that mode.
Specifically.
And then so you can play zombies with me, Austin?
Nah.
So
we can play zombies together?
Nah. I'm really good.
I'll show you how to play.
You know, I'll try it.
Really?
I'll try playing zombies mode with you one time at least.
One time?
I played those games. I don't really like them.
Okay.
I will give it a genuine, honest attempt
to
play through the Call of Duty zombies mode.
Okay.
I'll say my favorite thing about this before we move on is just the Call of Duty. There are people in the world who've played a lot of Call of Duty who have not played any Battle Royale. We were watching some folks on the IGN stream, and one of them was a video producer there named Bobby.
Bobby and Mitchell.
I don't know Bobby. I don't know if it was Mitchell. I thought it was Mitchell. It's not Mitchell. I think Mitchell was off mic.
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought it was. I don't remember the other guy's name.
Mitchell's on production.
I'm sorry. I feel like an asshole for
that. I thought
it was
like Larry on production.
There might have also been a Larry. IGN's big. They have 70 people. That's not true. I made that number up. They have a lot of people. But Bobby was a video producer who has spent a lot of time clearly playing Call of Duty and is, like, good at it. And, like, when a firefight popped off, he was incredible to watch. But then there was lots of moments where he was just like, this is scary. Like, he's just, like, in the world between locations.
Yeah.
And just being...
Like, saw the wall for the first time. I was like, what is that?
Yeah. It what is this weird blue wall? Extremely funny and in a good way. Like, I love the idea of this game mode coming to new audiences.
Right. Yeah,
obviously Fortnite's been everywhere, but like there are people who play Call of Duty, and it's cool to think about them getting the chance to like dip their toes in the genre.
Especially since Call of Duty has such a distinct feel, for
it's,
being a first-person shooter. Like, it is very distinct in its gameplay, and so.
Yep.
And I feel like that is the sort of obstacle between a lot of Call of Duty audiences from playing other first-person shooters like Fortnite, or Fortnite's third-person, but from playing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's cool that more people play.
Yeah. All right, let's take it to waypoints. We're going to skip the question bucket today because we've already gone very long. Do people have waypoints for the day? I'm getting some nods. Also, here's a thought. Here's a thing that I would love to hear from people is, would you like, if you're listening to this, to hear us do a longer form version of just waypoints, of just talking about things like whatever the things are that this group of people is about to bring to bear right now? things from the past, museum exhibits.
Anime.
Anime.
Gotcha games.
Gotcha games.
Horror movies of the 80s.
All the classics. Music.
Movies,
comic books. Video game. Oh, wait, no. We talked about video games.
Yeah,
we
got that one set.
But let us know. Shoot us a message on Twitter. You know where to find us. Waypoints. Who is up first? Who has something they are desperate to share?
I'm going to plug a podcast called Planet Money, but specifically an episode. And their Planet Money is a terrific NPR-produced podcast. If you want to know more about sort of like economic and financial issues, like broken down into like 15-minute, like easily digestible, like easily understood segments. I got turned on to it during the 2008 financial crisis, and because they like sat and explained very complicated concepts in a way that was like I didn't understand why people were losing their jobs, and like this podcast walked me through that, and I've continued to listen to them and since then. But they did this episode recently called "When Subaru Came Out," and it's an episode about how Subaru, the car manufacturer, was about to basically like go into bankruptcy, and they did a sort of a focus test to see like, well, who is buying our cars? Is there a way that we can sort of double down on those people? Like, who — they hadn't quite figured out like who buys Subarus, and they sort of by accident, and the podcast explains how, like, found out that Subarus were like really big among lesbians specifically. Huh. And so then they did a whole marketing campaign that was, you know, this is in the like early 90s, like during some of the AIDS crisis, and they did a targeted marketing campaign specifically at lesbians that was coded lesbian without being — a straight person would look at it and not understand why it was coded.
Right.
And but a lesbian could look at it and pick up on some of the subtle winks and nods that were going. And so it's a really fascinating episode. Ended up paying off. Like, then, like, Subarus weren't just like this niche thing in like certain LGBTQ communities. Like, it became a thing where like certain Subarus were like being sold at like exorbitant prices because like it's just a fascinating — they helped save the company, like turn the whole thing around. And it's a fascinating episode explaining like how they catered to like this really ignored market at a time when even considering like doing a campaign targeted at someone like that was considered sacrilege. And actually in the company, like, people weren't comfortable coming out while at the same time they were targeting, you know, yeah, a specific group. It's a fascinating little piece of like the ways that, you know, we often talk how capitalism is bad, and yet seeing yourself on like a billboard, seeing yourself — yep — on a giant ad, was important to a lot of people and ended up rewarding a company that took the time to highlight them. And it's just a fascinating little slice of history.
Awesome. Danielle, Rob?
Go ahead, Rob.
Sure. Yeah, let's see. Probably the coolest thing I've done lately, I went back to Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art, which is a museum in Northwest Massachusetts, and it's in this old converted mill, and it's this enormous space, really, and that's what kind of makes it interesting, is that it is extremely out of the way, an incredibly inconvenient location for an art museum. But it also means they get to do like colossal installations that you just wouldn't be able to pull — ooh — off. And certainly not like long-term installations. Like, it lets them like do stuff and run it for a year or two that like you wouldn't ever see probably in a major like urban museum, and certainly not for like that long, right? Because it just eats up so much space. One of the coolest things they've got running right now is this exhibition called Into the Light by James Turrell. And it's this series...
Kato just lifted his hands all the way up in the air.
It's this series of studies of light and our relationship to it. And it's hard to describe because, like, it is just this experiential, immersive exhibit as you encounter different forms of light in different contexts. But probably one of the coolest, like, to give you an idea of like what you're getting with this, there's this one room that you go down this long like corridor and it turns a couple times, and it cuts off all the day, all the light from the main part of the museum, and you're just like walking through pitch black. It's disorienting because you go from a well-lit like central space into like this darkened room, and the only thing that's visible in this room, there's two very, very low light like track lighting lamps, but then the center of this room on one wall, there is this massive blood red rectangle. It's almost like a luminescent Rothko painting in some ways. And it is so like deep and dark and like, again, blood red. You like, as you first encounter it, you're not even sure it's there. Like it almost comes across as an illusion. Like you keep faintly seeing the red, but then it disappears because your eyes haven't adjusted. So you keep like, is this even there? And you have no idea what is around you. Like I went in there with my partner, and once we like made a couple of those turns, I had no idea where she was. It was just like I was completely like night blind. But the cool thing is eventually your eyes adjust. And you get a sense of like, one, your eyes can adjust really far. Like this room that was almost pitch black, suddenly you're like looking around. Oh, there's benches in the back. You go sit in the benches. And this is where the other cool part comes into it. It's something I really like. Now you're in the back. You're actually behind the entry to the room. People come into this tunnel and they emerge in front of you. And they're blind. And you see them sort of groping around and like trying to get their bearings in the dark. And it is, again, because of that color and the darkness and the fact your eyes have adjusted, it is impossible not to feel this slightly, like, I don't know, it's this evocation of, like, almost a predatory perspective. But, like, you are the thing in the dark, suddenly. Like, you were that person a minute ago where you're like, I have no idea where I'm at, like, I'm kind of nervous, like, what's going on? And now, like, you are the thing inhabiting the darkness, and it encourages you to just be dead silent and like just invisible. And the other thing is a lot of these exhibits kind of call out makes you acutely conscious of the ways you experience light. The fact that you become aware of like the different way, like, you know how you have different sensitivity to forms of light in the physical structure of your eyes. You become acutely aware of like, oh, the center of your attention is dimmer. You do not have as much light sensitivity there. And so you also become aware of like how the brain begins to invent logic and order and shapes and images in just like light when there might be nothing at all. The light might not be changing at all, but your brain will eventually like convince itself there's something happening here. It is a series of exhibits like that. And they are incredibly cool. The last thing I'll say is there's a couple that you have to book in advance. There's one you walk into. It's this illuminated room called like Perfectly Clear. It is this massive installation. You walk into this like illuminated cube. You are surrounded by light. You have to put on little like little bunny slippers, almost like the little plastic bags that like CSIs wear, you know, over their shoes or like technicians, because you don't want to dirty the floor. Because again, it has to be like perfectly white. You go in there. And it is such an embracing and encompassing light that you lose all sense of like space. Like you have no spatial sense. Like you walk into what appears, I swear to God, like a solid green wall. Like I was like, they're like, no, you can go in 4 feet and then there's going to be a drop. So just expect that. I took 1 foot over the one step over the threshold and immediately I was like, where the hell am I? I don't – like this isn't a room. Like you are sending – I feel like Roadrunner going through that fucking mountain.
Right. It is such
a cool thing. And so highly recommended.
So that is, again, the name of the exhibit is
– James Turrell's Into the Light at Mass MoCA.
Awesome. T-U-R-R-E-L-L for James Turrell. Danielle.
So I've been watching The Twilight Zone again, the original Twilight Zone.
Lots of canted angles.
Lots of canted angles, quite a few. I'll talk about an episode that's a little lesser known. Not that it's not known, but, you know, I watched Time Enough at Last the other night, and of course that's a classic. That's the one where the nice little librarian person, he's not a librarian, he works at a bank, and he loses his glasses after he finally survives an apocalypse and is able to read all the books in his life, and it's very sad. It's a beautiful anti-war message, but also very sad. Okay, I watched that one the other night, but the one I kind of want to talk about a little bit is an episode called The Lonely, which was from the first season, I'll just read you that, like, Rod Serling little top part of it so you get oriented. Witness, if you will, a dungeon made out of mountains, salt flats, and the sands that stretch to infinity. The dungeon has an inmate, James A. Corey, and this is his residence, a metal shack. An old touring car that squats in the sun and goes nowhere, for there is nowhere to go. For the record, let it be known that James A. Corey is a convicted criminal placed in solitary confinement. Confinement in this case stretches as far as the eye can see, because this particular dungeon is on an asteroid 9 million miles from the Earth. Now witness, if you will, a man's mind and body shriveling in the sun, a man dying of loneliness. So, in this episode, that's how it starts.
Yeah.
It's a guy. He's part of this whole new sort of Earth Council's way of punishing people, which is putting them on an asteroid alone and being in horrifying solitary confinement. So it's about, you know, horrible penal codes, but it's also very much a proto androids rights, robots rights kind of thing, because a kindly space captain who comes by on his supply runs every 3 months, this guy gets a supply run of you know, food so he can survive in the sun. And he takes kindly upon James Corey, and he thinks that he was wrongfully convicted. He said, I believe you when you say you killed in self-defense and not, you know, you're not a murderer. So he leaves him a female robot, which he calls Robit. They all say Robit.
Great.
This whole time.
No one knows.
Throughout the whole episode, Robit. She's a Robit. And it's very much about love and falling in love with artificial intelligence. Obviously, the entire show is so ridiculously sexist. It's not even funny. I mean, this is literally from the 50s. And there are obviously a lot of episodes that are fairly progressive, that have very progressive ideals. But you really do have to kind of put yourself in that mindset of like, okay, this sure is from a different time. And it sure is capable of being read in many interesting and nuanced ways. But... yeah, really, really fascinating episode. I'm really enjoying going back and watching a lot of these. The show is so unsubtle and so wonderful in a lot of ways. And there are, of course, some horrible, goofy episodes as well.
Sure.
Those are so much fun to watch. Actually, the terrible, like, dog shit episodes that were like, oh, Rod, buddy, I don't know where this draft came from, but all right, that's fine. But yeah, really, really enjoying it. And that's a good one to watch. It's an interesting one to watch.
I cannot wait for Jordan Peele's upcoming.
Yeah, when is that? When is that?
It's shooting now.
Okay.
It's sometime
2019,
spring of next year. Okay. But he was recently asked about it, and they were like, "Come on, man, do the voice, like be the intro." And he was like, "No." He was like, "That was my rule up front." And he said, "But I'm starting to reconsider."
That's
good.
Exciting.
I hope he does it.
I want to quickly shout out an article by Colin Space Twinks called The Giant Robot Series That's a Civics Lesson in Disguise, which is up over on VRV. It is an article about an anime series called Pat Labor, The Early Years. I want to surprise everybody. It's about giant robots.
What?
I know. Totally, totally wild that I bring mechs to bear. Here's just a brief paragraph. It's an old as dirt observation that mecha anime isn't really about the mecha, but Pat Labor is not only not about the mecha, nor the people that are piloting them, nor even the people who have to repair them, but every part of society the giant cop robots would have to coexist with, the pre-existing systems, societies, and bureaucracies they slot into, and the new ones they create by virtue of their existence. The result is a vision of the future focused on the nuts and bolts of daily life, luring the viewer in with promises of hot-blooded mech action and then saying, okay, but what I really want to talk about is how they'd handle the paperwork for pension benefits and property damage. It's a great piece.
Awesome.
It's really good. It's worth reading. The show itself is also fairly strong. I haven't seen it in probably 5 or 6 years. But this reading this piece made me want to go back and read it again. It's called The Giant Robot Series That's a Civics Lesson in Disguise.
Beautiful.
So that is my waypoint. Natalie and Kato, do either of you have something quickly before we wrap up?
Mm.
I know I'm kind of springing this on you.
Great British Bake Off is a really nice show for night. Nighttime.
I saw some of that for the first time this weekend.
It's so good.
People had to make a little food sculpture, and some people didn't do well.
But the judges
were so nice about it.
But sometimes they're nice, but sometimes they're just like, this is awful. But they smile, so it's fine.
I recommend not eating that.
Yeah, I wouldn't eat that. So, wow. I don't know. The show's good because it doesn't make me, Austin and I had this conversation where it doesn't make us hungry when we're watching it late at night, but it's nice to watch late at night.
It's nice to watch. It's not like watching like a regular cooking show where,
where it's like,
yo, I could eat whatever that is you're cooking right now.
Yeah, the other one, the Great British Bake Off is like, I appreciate the craft that is going into this, but I do not feel the need to consume this
right
now.
It's too late to eat a cake.
It's too late to eat a cake. Yeah. I don't like cake.
It's too late to eat a cake.
Oh, we already went through this, that you guys don't like cake.
So, anyway. I had a friend who was this close to getting a contestant spot on the American version they were considering doing of the Great British Bake Off, which fell apart due to some unsavory reasons, apparently. But anyway, she's a very good baker, but she was like raising her game, and I was like hanging out around at their house. And it was very bad and destructive because she was definitely enjoying herself, but like she was like, here, I just baked this like seven layer cake, but it wasn't a cake. It was also like a flaky pastry. It was like a puff pastry layer cake. It was a weird thing. It was delicious. And, like, you have a little bit of that. And she's like, I didn't quite nail it, did I? She would pick it up from in front of you into the trash.
Oh, no.
And she was like, I'm going to make another one. Give me a couple hours. And so, like, even as she's doing that, like, you're still getting fed a lot of fucking cake.
Right.
And,
of
like, I love cake.
That's a lot of cake.
I love cake. And so she keeps bringing out cake. And I'm like, well, I guess I want to help you get on the show. So I'll just, you know what? I don't know.
I need to get that
mouthfeel just right.
Shout out to Supreme Bakery for making us a Spyro cake last week that Activision sent us. Go to the socials to see that one.
To see the updates on that.
Kato, do you have a waypoint before we close?
Play Destiny.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Play Destiny, says Kato. That's a thing.
Patrick says no.
Kato and some folks from the community actually may be doing a fresh playthrough of the raid when it drops on Friday. So stay tuned on our socials for that. Those socials, by the way, you can find at twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice, over on youtube.com/waypointvice, and twitch.tv/waypoint. You can follow me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Let's go around the room, real and virtual. Natalie, where can people find you?
At Natalie Watson.
Kato.
@Kato_appears.
Danielle.
@DanielleRI.
Patrick Klepek.
@PatrickKlepek.
And Rob.
@RobZachney.
As always, shout outs to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the album Pale Machine, or the Pale Machine album. Maybe I say it like that from now on. Find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. And as always, Danielle, how do we take them out? How do we say it to them? What do we say? What are words?
What are words? They're very important. And we say, be good and be good at it.
Peace.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.